Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this first hour of Focus, we will be talking about fairy tales. And our guest for the program is Jack Zipes. He is one of the country's leading folklore experts. He's been professor of German at the University of Minnesota since 1989. And he is the editor of the Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales, published by the Oxford University Press, a book that's come out fairly recently. And it's an interesting book. It is arranged as a reference work, but it's also the kind of book that one could dip into here and there for a little bit of reading. The articles are short, and you can indeed look up something like Hans Christian Andersen, for example. There are entries here on folktale collectors and creators. You can look up specific stories. So you can look up, Beauty and the Beast, for example. But there's also information on composers who have done work based on fairy tales, on ballets, on artists, many, many different interesting articles. And if you're interested in things like where these stories come from, how it is we have the versions that we have, perhaps what it is they say about people at various places and times who've told these stories, this is a book that you can use to find answers to questions like that. Our guest, Jack Zipes, has written a number of books himself on fairy tales. Just to mention a few, Fairy Tales and the Art of Subversion, The Complete Fairy Tales of the Brothers Grimm, Beauties, Beasts, and Enchantment, Classic French Fairy Tales, and there are a number. So if you're interested in this subject, you can certainly head down to the library, to the bookstore, look for his books. And, of course, in the bookstore now, if you like to look at it, is the Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales. The subtitle is The Western Fairy Tale Tradition from Medieval to Modern. As we talk this morning with Jack Zipes, questions certainly are welcome, and I know he will do his best to give you an answer. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you might be listening this morning. And that's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-9455. WILL, those are the numbers. And at any point, people can call in. All we ask of callers is people just try to keep their questions, comments brief, just so we can keep our program moving along. Professor Zipes, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure.
What is a fairy tale? What qualifies?
That's quite a difficult question to answer because the fairy tale itself has changed so much from the time that it originated. Approximately, we're talking about the literary fairy tale in the 16th century and up to the present. I mean, you can say, for instance, that something like Harry Potter qualifies as a fairy tale today, or a short fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm still qualifies as a fairy tale today. There are novels that qualify as fairy tales. Novel like Possession by A.S. Byatt could be considered a fairy tale. Angela Carter has written some very feminist fairy tales that vary in length and complexity, or Robert Coover, a postmodern writer. But I would say that there are some sort of conventional motifs and tapoi that you'll always find in fairy tales, and the most important one, of course, is that there will be a type of magical transformation or miraculous transformation that is central or key to the fairy tale. And it generally involves a hero or heroine who abandons home or is chased out of home or goes on a mission or is given an assignment and goes off into the world, generally into the woods, and experiences types of conflicts or struggles that brings out the very best, for the most part, in the hero or heroine, and leads to a transformation and to a type of rise in social status or improvement so that another sort of key sign to most fairy tales is its utopian quality. That is, the most fairy tales, although there are today tragic fairy tales as well, but most fairy tales have a sense that the world can be changed for the better, that there are better worlds out there, and that the hero or heroine winds up in the better world or the utopian world. That's a long definition.
Well, it's I think that that's okay, because I know that it's an easy, straightforward question to ask.
Right.
But that it's not such an easy and straightforward thing to define.
Right, it's a changing genre for the better, because it's just wonderful to see the types of innovations that particularly contemporary writers and musicians, composers and artists have come up with. I mean, also there's a great tradition of fairy tale illustration.
I think it is also interesting to encourage people to think about this as a living form, not just something that people did a long time ago. Maybe they have this idea that, well, these stories, whoever did sort of the first versions of these stories, it was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. They continue to be told. They were passed on through the oral tradition. They have now been popularized by first writers and illustrators, and then once we get into things like motion pictures and animated cartoons and television, they've continued to evolve, and they use the same sorts of stories that people told. But indeed, it's not just something where we're continuing to reinterpret an old text. New texts are being created, so it continues to be a living form.
I agree with you completely. One of the most fascinating things is the way most TV commercials are based on fairy tales. You just have to watch about an hour of practically any TV station or TV programming, and when you have the publicity or the commercials, they generally involve, if you use the right type of shampoo, you will change from this beast into this very handsome man. Mm. And you'll be able to do many different things. Or if you wear some type of athletic shoe like Nike, you'll be able to fly through the air. Like those are the seven league boots, of course. So we use fairy tales practically every day in our lives, or they're represented or reflected in many different ways.
When you, and I know that one of the things that folklorists do is they collect stories, different kinds of stories, and they look at what exactly are the essential stories, and then make some effort to classify them. And the idea there is perhaps to get at the question, are there some really basic sort of issues that people are interested in and continue to tell stories about and mull and think about over time, so much to the extent that we can say, if you look at fairy tales, we can see there maybe are 5 or 6 or 10 or something like that, basic stories that people continue to tell, maybe with small differences, but they continue to tell. Is that the case, or how much is that the case?
I think so. I think that there are certain issues that, for instance, that revolve around gender identity, that fairy tales introduce, and because we have not resolved a lot of the questions that with regard to gender roles and what appropriate roles are and how to raise children, our violence in our society, a lot of these questions that fairy tales introduce remain relevant because we haven't resolved them and we keep revisiting them. To give you an example, to be more concrete, I've studied and I've actually written a whole book on Little Red Riding Hood. And for me, my interpretation is that Little Red Riding Hood is a tale of violation, or to put it more bluntly, a tale of rape in which the young girl in the tale, at least in the first literary tale, is blamed for her own violation and the violation of the granny. Now, that small tale, which is no longer than 3 or 4 pages, depending on the print, involves questions of how males and females deal with one another around the question of desire. Should a girl go into the woods? Is it permissible for a girl to go into the woods? Is it permissible for her to be adventurous? Or is she punished if she goes into the woods by her own? Is her appropriate place in the home? Should she be domesticated? Are all males wolves? Are they all predatory animals? These are the questions that a fairy tale can raise, and authors from going all the way back to the 17th century to the present have written numerous, thousands actually, versions that talk about the relationship between the sexes. Mm-hmm. And for the very reason that we have not resolved in a satisfactory way how the sexes relate to one another, this tale, this very small tale, remains very pertinent today.
I'd like to introduce, at this point, reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Jack Zipes. He's professor of German at the University of Minnesota and one of the country's leading folklore experts. He's written a number of books on fairy tales, and he's also the editor of the recently published Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales. It's quite an interesting book. And so if you're interested in the subject, you might go out and take a look at it in the bookstore. Questions also welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I want to tell now also people who are listening, and you, Professor Zipes, that we just have gotten word within the last few minutes that maybe about 10:30, Governor Bush is going to make a statement about the current situation in Florida, and we've decided that we will carry that. So but we're not sure when it's going to start. So you'll have to kind of bear with us. We expect that it will be relatively short, so that means we'll take a little time out from the show. When that happens, it may happen kind of suddenly, and what we'll do, Professor Zipes, if you don't mind, is we'll just put you on hold. You can hang on, and then when he's finished, we'll continue. So just a heads up for you and people who are listening.
Okay.
And my apology for the interruption, but we thought it was newsworthy, so we would go ahead and let people hear.
It certainly is.
I'm interested in going back just for a second to Red Riding Hood, because as you say, if you look at some of the older versions of this story, clearly they seem to be cautionary tales, and that women are being warned about warned about wolves that go on 2 feet, not on 4, and
exactly.
Sort of the idea of the story is, well, you get in bed with a wolf, you get in trouble. Don't be surprised.
A sexist message, a sexist implication, because the tale was, of course, written way back in the 17th century when the patriarchal society was very, very strong, and the implication is girls who go out into the woods and speak to wolves deserve what they can get. It's a type of ideology that is with us today. There's an implication in that tale that I think is very negative with regard to the way we talk about what happens when a young girl is seduced or raped or violated.
Mm.
And that's why, in fact, a lot of feminist writers, beginning with Anne Sexton and other writers like Olga Brumis or Angela Carter, have rewritten the tale and have tried to show that there are other ways that men and women, using these symbols of the girl and the wolf, can relate to one another.
Well, that is the very question I was going for. And now I think that the version of the story now that seems to be most current, the one that people would be familiar with, is different. It's it's a story that seems to show us the resourcefulness of Red Riding Hood. And in fact, she manages to triumph in the end. The wolf is destroyed. How is it that we now we've had a major switch here in the outcome and perhaps the point of the story? How did we go from that first version where the moral is, where you take a chance like this, you get what you deserve, to the second version that where the heroine is sort of spunky and resourceful and manages to come out on top?
Right. Well, I think that's thanks in part to the feminist movement, you know, from the late 1960s to the present, although we've experienced a type of backlash in feminism in the last 10 or 15 years or so. But nevertheless, I think women and men think differently. Not totally. What's fascinating about the fairy tale is that it represents a type of symbolical discourse through which we debate a lot of these very key issues in our society. And I agree with you that the paradigm has shifted quite a bit. But nevertheless, that old tale is still being republished and reprinted, and a lot of people think that the old tale, the classical tale, which in quotes I think is sexist and somewhat negative, still circulates and is believed in and accepted by a majority of people, but a good number of people still believe that, and a good number of people now believe in the new version. Hmm. And so we have this struggle in our society that's reflected in these fairy tales, and I think really livens or brings about a very productive discussion about the types of roles that boys and girls, men and women, should play in our society.
For a long time, these stories that we're talking about were stories that were part of the oral tradition. They were passed on by people telling them, and that's the way you learned them or came across these stories, if you heard it told. And there, one of the things that we know can happen is that each person can then, in a sense, own the story for himself or herself, because if you're telling it, you can introduce whatever sorts of details you like. I suppose you can't really depart. Maybe you feel you can't depart from the central idea of the story, but in a sense, you can in some ways manipulate it to the way that you like. When these stories move from the oral tradition to the written tradition, and the text becomes fixed, or at least there become fixed versions, does that really stop the process of, well, I guess we already know the answer because we've sort of talked about that. Does that stop the process, or does it not stop the process of change for that story?
Not really. I think a lot of people have argued that, have said, you know, once a text becomes fixed, you know, that's the end of it. There's the sort of definitive version, or we can always go back to that text. What it does is it preserves a particular version, you know, by that author who either spoke it or just wrote it down. The fascinating thing is that people read it and they like the story, but they want to change it. And so they take a printed version and will retell it in their own words. In fact, I do it. I am... among other things, a storyteller, and I work with children in elementary schools. And if I find a story that I love that's been written by either a living author or a dead author, I will appropriate it or expropriate it and retell it in my own words, and sometimes I'll even rewrite it or adapt it in a certain way and publish it or print it. And so we have this continuous, almost dialectical exchange that goes on with almost every good story that's been told. And it takes different forms, sometimes printed forms or oral forms, but it's a continuous process of retelling, which again I think is very exciting and important, because these retellings reflect changes in society, changes in our customs, in our morals, in our philosophies, and we can learn a great deal from the reprinting or studying, as a lot of folklorists do. They study very carefully the backgrounds, the socio-cultural backgrounds of these stories.
I'm sure that there are parts of the world where telling these kinds of stories is still considered to be a form for everyone, that everyone can participate and hear and get something out of it. I think that for us, probably in most of the industrial world at this point, we have come to think of these stories as things that are for children. Mm-hmm. And also for that reason, then, the stories have been changed in certain ways. Perhaps we think that children, there are certain things that are too much for them that we don't want to expose them to. We think maybe there shouldn't be a lot of violence, or there shouldn't be difficult issues or things that are sort of unresolved. And for that reason, then, versions of these stories have been produced that I'm sure folklorists feel have had all the life drained out of them.
Right. You're exactly right. Unfortunately, we have this, I would call it a warped view with regard to what children can enjoy and understand and accept. And we tend to categorize children almost in a very, not almost, but in a condescending way. And this, of course, did not occur even 100 or 200 years ago when stories were told in front of children of every kind, also with scatological elements in the stories. And over the years, though, we have felt that we've had to protect children from these lurid things, or erotic body, or evil, or unchristian things that are in these tales. And I think that's a mistake, because children are very, very intelligent and very alert, and they are also, as we know from child psychologists, they experience violence from the day they're born in different ways, and they learn to absorb and understand the world through conflict and struggle. And I think that that we tend to be overly protective in our society today. I don't mean that children should be exposed to everything out there in the world. Certainly, they're very sensitive and can be traumatized by different types of stories or images. But I do think that with a parent, an understanding parent or an adult next to the child telling a story, I think you can practically tell almost any tale and tell it in a way that the child's eyes will be opened up to the world and learn a great deal. So I do think that one of the dangers, paradoxically, is that the more we seek to protect our children, the more we harm them.
Well, we're at the midpoint of the program here, and let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with Jack Zipes. He teaches German. He's professor of German at University of Minnesota and has been there since 1989 and has done a lot of writing on fairy tales. He's published a number of books dealing with fairy tales. So if you're interested, you can certainly go to the library, go to the bookstore, look for some of his work. And also, he is the editor of the Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales, which has just recently been published. And it makes interesting reading. It's published by the Oxford University Press, and as I mentioned, it has information on various kinds of stories. You can look up and read about some of the classics like, for example, Red Riding Hood. There are also entries on people who have collected and have composed and collected and passed on these stories, various kinds of artists who have been inspired by fairy tales. And it's the kind of the book that is intended as a reference, but is also the kind of thing that every once in a while you can just pick it up and dip into it and find some interesting little details. We're also here expecting that sometime in the next half an hour, we're going to have a statement from George W. Bush about what's been going on with the election in Florida. It's going to be live. Coverage going to be provided to us by National Public Radio, and we're going to carry that. But we don't know exactly when that's going to happen, so it might be an abrupt shift here. We'll just do that. We'll take a little time out, and I think we're expecting probably it won't be more than maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll continue with whatever time left we have of this part of Focus 580. So stay with us. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just to pick up on the point you're talking about before, there have been people who have been interested in folk tales and fairy tales and looked at them with just this sort of issue in mind, that is, what sort of function they can have for children who are going through a lot of changes, who are trying to adjust themselves to adult roles, the challenges of adult life, and the fact that you maybe feel that you're a small person in a world of very big, sometimes threatening persons. I guess the individual I think of most who wrote about this, or perhaps in a form that was best known, was Bruno Bettelheim, who wrote this book called The Uses of Enchantment, in which he makes that argument. Is that something that you feel makes some sense?
Yes and no. I know the book quite well, and actually I've written an essay about Bruno Bettelheim's approach to fairy tales, and I think there are there's one very, very good point that he makes when he insists, first of all, well, two good points, when he wrote the book, there was a tendency among parents to prevent the children from reading the original versions of the Brothers Grimm. For instance, in Cinderella, at the end, the two stepsisters have their eyes pecked out, and they also cut off parts of their feet to try to have their feet fit the slipper in the Grimm's fairy tales. And a lot of parents in the 60s and 70s were reluctant to read these original tales. They wanted the sanitized versions, and Bruno Bettelheim argued that these conflicts, no matter how grotesque or how brutal or violent some of the scenes might be, represent certain conflicts that children go through even when they're infants, and it's very, very important that children be exposed to these fairy tales, because they are not realistic for children. They enable children to understand the world through symbols. In other words, they can distance themselves from these tales because they really don't directly reflect their own situation and yet have a bearing possibly on their situation. For instance, if there's sibling rivalry or there's an Oedipal complex or problems with the parents, these tales will therapeutically help children come to terms with some of the psychological problems that they have. And I think that there's a certain truth to what he says. But I stop short at what he says, because he then goes on to interpret, I think it was about 15 or so tales in great detail, in a very strict Freudian or neo-Freudian manner, in which he almost like imposes imposes an interpretation on all of these tales. This is what they'll do. It's almost as though if you read this tale to a child, then the child, like almost like a Pavlovian dog, will respond to the tale in a certain prescribed Freudian way. And I think that his book tends to be somewhat autocratic and authoritarian in its approach to fairy tales, which defeats the very, very purpose of the book itself. So I have a critical take on what Bettelheim was trying to develop in his book. I do think it's an interesting book, but it's to be, I think, read with great care.
When just I'm going back to the sort of discussion we have about the content of the stories and sometimes people's desire to drain out some of the more difficult, problematic, or violent stuff when we present them to children, and how perhaps that the story is really losing something, and that the readers are actually losing something. Is it possible to take a sort of a case study, a story that people might be familiar with, and to talk about how it is that a popular children's version, what the popular children's version is like, and then if you actually look at the essential parts of the story, what sort of things get left on out, and why it is we should prefer one version over another?
Yeah, it certainly is. With almost any of the canonical what I call the canonical fairy tales, we can do case studies and see to what extent changes have been made and have been left, or certain things have been left and certain things have been left out, and we can try to understand the reasons for this. And understand them with regard to what they mean for culture or for society or for particular cultures and societies. Let me give you an example. Puss in Boots, since we haven't talked about that particular fairy tale. Mm-hmm. The first literary version of Puss in Boots can be found in a book published by an Italian writer. His name is John Francesco Straparola. And he wrote a collection of tales and fairy tales in 1550 called The Pleasant Knights. In this particular tale of Puss in Boots, it's not actually called Puss in Boots. It has another title altogether. It's called Fortunato. And in that particular tale, the cat is actually a female fairy who helps a bumbling peasant when the father dies, and takes pity on him and manages to help him eventually marry the daughter of a king, and he inherits a kingdom and is very, very grateful. And in that tale, we see a female female cat helping and making this, civilizing this young bumbling peasant. And then in the next version, literary version that we know of, is by another Italian by the name of Giambattista Basili, in a book that was published in 1634, a collection of fairy tales. In that particular tale, again, we have a female cat, and the plot varies somewhat. But this female cat, Cagliostro, changes again another bumbling peasant, but then is ungrateful in the end and tries to kill the cat. And the cat escapes this peasant after the peasant's become wealthy, and says, "Is this the gratitude that I get from such a bumbling hero? I'm not going to stay around to be killed by you," and runs off. And so you have a very problematic fairy tale, but again, it's due to the graces of a female cat, a talking cat, that this hero succeeds. And then the next version, which remains with us, is by Charles Perrault in 1697, and the cat now becomes a male cat, and the male cat is a very clever, cunning, and in fact a killer cat, because it kills an ogre in the end and achieves status, social status, and represents, in my interpretation, the rise of a type of middle-class cat or middle-class individual who becomes this master cat. And from that point on, this version of Puss in Boots remains with us. It remains the dominant version in the Western world. And these other two versions, which are fascinating and really well written, are obfuscated because they really do not reinforce a certain pattern of behavior that becomes acceptable in the Western world. And if we use or if we study the different versions of Puss in Boots up to the present, because of course there are numerous versions that are different today, but if we study and look at the shifts, we can learn a great deal again about gender roles, about power, about how one succeeds in society, the whole question of gratitude and the relationship between a master and a servant. All of these questions are raised by this wonderful fairy tale, and the shifts, the way the fairy tale has changed, reveals a great deal about the way we behave in society today, what becomes acceptable in terms of striving for power.
We are here at the point where we're coming into about our last 10 or 12 minutes in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Jack Zipes. He's professor of German at the University of Minnesota and has written a good deal on fairy tales. He is also the editor of the recently published Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales. The subtitle is The Western Fairy Tale Tradition from Medieval to Modern. We have a couple of callers here. Well, let's see if we can get him in, starting out with a caller in Champaign County and on line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the contemporary computer games and are a substitute for fairy tales, and that the participatory quality of those games lets the player be part author.
Yes. Well, it depends on the game, of course. And I'm not that familiar with all the games out there, and I have not come across a type of fairy tale, or explicit, let me put it that way, computer game which uses fairy tales. But certainly...
Well, it's a modern
right.
story that could be a fairy tale in itself, not necessarily a retelling of something in the past.
Yes, I agree with you. There's something miraculous about the computer games and technology today, which, by the way, was anticipated by Hans Christian Andersen in many of his fairy tales, in which he introduces talking objects and mechanical objects that do amazing things. So even in the traditional classical fairy tale, or even going back to the Arabian Nights where you have flying carpets, the fairy tale does anticipate what is going on in our world today. And I do think that these changes are being reflected in the types of games and also through the Internet, the way the fairy tale is going to be changed in the future. It's anyone's guess.
Well, let's turn this into an argument, then, in this respect.
Okay.
If there are positive psychosocial aspects to the goriness of Grimm and his successors, then are there positive psychosocial aspects to the computer games that we shouldn't attempt to squelch and control?
Yes. I think that a lot... I'm not one of these... I'm a critic of children's literature, but I certainly am very wary about censoring violence in the... films and in the stories that children read. I think that it's very, very important to see what is represented or reflected in films or in the games as an indication of where society is at, and they allow children to come to terms with problems that we should not veil. And of course, adults are at the root of many of these problems. So I think the question is not so much should there be violence, should we conceal or censure films or stories that have violence in them. The question is, do these stories actually reveal certain things that are going on in society that we can resolve? Can they help us resolve a lot of the problems that we face in our society? Do they conceal? Are they untruthful? These are some of the questions I think that we should be asking.
I appreciate the caller's question. Let's go to somebody else here. This is Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, I have a question. How did the fairy tales change to adapt to American culture when the old roles in European society were differentiated here in America? There's a lot more freedom and a lot less lords and ladies and things like that.
Right. They did and didn't. I mean, we have our own. We have a very strong Native American and African American tradition that still continues. We have a lot of folk tales and fairy tales that are being written down and published that emanate from tribal systems. But we also have a literary tradition that does take off from and reflect a definite Americanization. It begins, of course, with Washington Irving and Nathaniel Hawthorne, both who wrote fairy tales that had a lot to do with the Puritanical or the Dutch traditions and rewrote certain tales or adapted tales that had to do with the American experience. But, of course, the two foremost writers of fairy tales, particularly for children, at the end of the 19th century were Frank Stockton, who not too many people know, but who wrote for the St. Nicholas magazine and published big collections of fairy tales in the 1890s. But the most eminent, of course, is L. Frank Baum with The Wizard of Oz, which has become sort of our mythic American fairy tale. If you look at the first novel of the 14 novels that he wrote about Oz, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, it's a pure and simple, the structure is pure and simple European fairy tale, but very American. I mean, all the content, the characters, and the dream-like experiences all have to do with the American society. And I think that Baum, through the popularity of his work, and then later on with Johnny Guel and the Raggedy Ann, Raggedy Andy series, those were the authors at the beginning of the 20th century that really grounded a type of what I would call an American fairy tale tradition that James Thurber continued in the 1930s to a certain extent, and many writers are continuing today.
Mm. That's interesting. Just not very long ago on the program, we talked with a writer who has written a lot about Baum and who was the editor of it's the centennial edition of the book, which is annotated, which has just recently come out, because it was published in 1900 for the first time, and that was one of the things that we talked about. And in fact, right on the very first page, or before that first book begins, Baum actually says that he says that he created that because he felt the need for what he called a truly American kind of fairy tale, something that he apparently thought was needed and was lacking. And he had this idea that, yes, these European stories were not quite right for the American context.
Mm-hmm. That's true. What's fascinating also about Baum is that we were just talking about violence. He was more or less a pacifist, and he refused to have any violence in his fairy tales. There are a few scenes, you know, where people die, but they're always by accidents.
Mm-hmm.
And he was somebody who really found a way in all 14 of the Oz novels to talk about conflict and talk about a lot of social problems in a way that really reduced, I think, the effect, the negative effect that violent descriptions might have on children.
Mm. One thing that that to me seemed to be noteworthy about The Wizard of Oz is that the hero of the story was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at fairy tales, and when you look at the people who have the power in the stories, how does this break down according to gender?
he was really in many ways a great innovator and very radical by introducing Dorothy as a heroine. It is very unusual, particularly at the end of the 19th century or beginning of the 20th century, to have such a resourceful young heroine like Dorothy as a major figure in all of his works. And of course, he published these works up until 1919. So he was ahead of his times in his thinking. A lot of people, you know, he had three sons, and he'd always wanted to have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of critics interpret his introducing Dorothy as a heroine in his stories as sort of his ersatz daughter or child, his dream child, whatever the case may be, and because that's speculative, he was unusual. He was married to the daughter of one of the leading suffragettes of the time, so he may have consciously decided that he is going to contribute to the suffragette movement by portraying a young girl as a heroine of his fairy tale.
Hmm. Well, we've come to the point where we're going to have to stop, and we managed to get through without any interruptions. and barely, of course, just scratched the surface of what is an enormous subject area. So first of all, I would like to say, Professor Zipes, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you again for inviting me.
Our guest, Jack Zipes, he's professor of German at the University of Minnesota, has authored a number of books on fairy tales. If you're interested, you can certainly look for them. And also, you might want to look at the book that we have mentioned here this morning. It's The Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales, edited by Jack Zipes, and certainly with contributions by a lot of other writers and scholars. It's published by the Oxford University Press, has come out fairly recently, and back in the spring, and will be out in bookstores. So you might want to take a look at it.